This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Why many job seekers just stop looking. Bank of America tries to cozy up with its customers. And hey, Mom, a robot just graded my English essay. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, April 5th. 88,000, that's the number of jobs created last month, according to the Labor Department. Now, that's not a big number, and it rattled the markets today. Still, unemployment fell a bit, down to 7.6%. In theory, that's good news, except that's mostly because a lot of folks have given up looking for work. What economists call labor force participation is now lower than it was during the recession. From the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty Desk, Chrissy Clark reports.
Missing workers. That's what labor economist Heidi Scherholz at the Economic Policy Institute calls them.
The group of workers who are not in the labor force, but who would be if job prospects were strong, is around 4 million right now.
Some of them decided to leave the workforce, say to raise a child, and aren't going back in the face of poor job prospects. Then there are those who lost their job and, after trying for months, have just stopped looking.
I thought, you know, why am I doing this? I've already been down this road and it hasn't led to anything.
Ross Anderson is a 58-year-old from Minnesota who's had a career in the manufacturing industry. A few years ago, he applied for 5 different jobs that he eventually found out were the same job posted by different recruiters. He was so frustrated for a while, he just gave up.
We find a lot of our personal identity through our work, and without having work, you know, we really get kind of lost.
Laura Lebovich hears frustrations like this all the time. She's president of the Career Strategy Group. When people do take a break from looking for work, she suggests networking or a hobby.
Because you're using the good part of your brain, the part of your brain that is actually doing something that you love to do, whereas we don't love to job search. It's just a fact.
As for Ross Anderson, eventually he did find another job through word of mouth, but he lost that one a few weeks ago when the company downsized. This time, he's determined not to get discouraged. To stay busy and attract future employers, he's just started a blog about his field. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Joining me now to discuss jobs and other news for the Weekly Wrap are Catherine Rampell of the New York Times and Sudeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Hey, sir.
So, Catherine, let's start with you. I know you've written a lot recently about the labor market and some of these discouraged workers. When you hear people like Ross Anderson, that gentleman in Chrissy's piece, do you think he's typical?
Certainly there's a lot of discouragement out there,
yeah.
But many workers don't really have the luxury of just giving up because they don't have any other source of income. So, I mean, there are a lot of people who certainly get discouraged, who feel like their prospects are nil or close to it, but they have to keep pounding the pavement because their unemployment checks ran out. You know, they don't have any other source of income.
Yeah. And you mentioned in your writing this week, companies really are not making it easy for people who are looking. You talked a little bit about this hiring paralysis, companies afraid to make a hire. And I think you talked to one guy who'd been called back numerous times for job interviews.
That's absolutely true. You're seeing job openings staying open longer than they used to. And one explanation for that, and there are many, is that employers are just terrified of making a mistake. They have an opening. They know they need to fill it, whether it's because of attrition or there's a new position with new demand coming in. but they're still really tentative about whether their business is going to hold up, whether they're going to have the demand going forward, and if they're going to take the plunge and make a hire, they really want to make sure it's that perfect person, what HR people are starting to call the purple squirrel of a job candidate. So they're making job applicants go through lots of hoops.
Yeah. So, Sudeep, go to today's jobs report, only 88,000 jobs created last month. Can we blame this on the sequester, or is that too easy?
It would be too easy to blame it right now on the sequester. In a few months, you won't have much difficulty doing that.
Right.
It's really a bit of a mystery here how we can have so many months of relatively strong job growth and then just suddenly snap back. And it partly seems like a cruel joke to see this year after year after year in the labor market. But there's something fundamental going on now that is certainly affecting us. We saw in early January, payroll taxes rise. And it's been a bit of a conundrum why we haven't seen that hitting the economy more quickly. So to get to the end of March and early April, and perhaps seeing it in a jobs report, because we saw the retail sector shed 24,000 jobs over the course of the month, that may be the first sign that consumers are holding back on their spending, and retailers, of course, are going to have to cut jobs as well due to that effect.
Yeah. Catherine, what was your big takeaway from today's report?
I think it's that the numbers were very disappointing, but we always need to keep in mind the fact that it's 1 month.
Yeah.
These numbers get revised a lot. You know, I remember there was a month, I think it was last summer, when it looked like we had zero job growth, and that got revised way up to over 100,000 jobs. So, you know, you just have to keep your fingers crossed and hope that when the Labor Department takes a second crack at it, that maybe the numbers will look better. I mean, that's not the most hopeful way of looking at scientific way of looking at the economic data, but yeah. You just have to hope that it's a blip.
Real quick, Sudeep, the president is apparently going to offer cuts to Social Security and other entitlement programs in his budget proposal due out next week. What do you think the chances are that those cuts are going to happen?
They will happen eventually. They're probably not going to happen this year. We've seen the president and Congress go through this same dance over and over the last few months. These kinds of issues have been on the table. They've been as part of deals before, and either people in Congress didn't bite, or just because of raw politics, whatever the president was offering just wasn't going to be good enough anyway. And so this is certainly going to advance the debate a little bit more and raise the political pressure on Congress to achieve something. But it really doesn't look like in this environment Congress is going to step up in a way that in any different way than it has before.
Yeah. Okay, we got to go. Sudeep Reddy of the Wall Street Journal and Catherine Rampell of the New York Times. Thanks a lot, guys, and have a great weekend.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thanks.
Those job numbers soured the mood on Wall Street. Details when we do the numbers. Corporate heads rolled this week. Lululemon's chief product officer is leaving after that yoga pants debacle. The pants turned out to be see-through and had to be pulled from the shelves. Hewlett-Packard's chairman resigned after a botched acquisition. Chevron docked executive pay over industrial accidents. But none was as extreme as JCPenney. The board of the struggling retailer cut top executives' pay by more than 96%. A 96% pay cut? Why not just fire a CEO instead? And why would a punished CEO stay? Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
In 2011, JCPenney hired Ron Johnson away from Apple to turn the company around. Hopes were high, and so was pay. JCPenney offered Johnson a compensation package that topped $53 million. Most of that was in stock. In 2012,
they didn't give him a bonus. They didn't give him any equity awards. And all he really had was a salary.
That's Aaron Boyd of Equilar, an executive compensation data firm. Ron Johnson's salary is $1.5 million, and he gets some perks. Compare that to the package he got when he was hired, and you're looking at a pay cut of more than 96%.
Which is a problem I'd like to have surviving on $1.5 million a year.
Ralph Ward is the publisher of Boardroom Insider. Large as Johnson's salary sounds, he says, that pay cut sends a strong message. So why didn't the board just fire him?
Because because then that would put the board in the position of saying, okay, what's our fallback plan? And I suspect they don't have one.
Or the board is willing to give Johnson more time, says Charles Elson, a corporate governance expert at the University of Delaware. Elson says the pay cut sends a we're not messing around message to shareholders, but he also sees it as a vote of confidence in Johnson. The board did wipe out Johnson's bonus, but it also raised his base salary.
Obviously, they believe that there is merit in the individual, and they didn't think it was time to cut the line.
Cutting CEO pay packages is a growing trend, says Equilar's Aaron Boyd.
Companies are much more sensitive to investor sentiment regarding pay. We're starting to see pay reflect how the companies are performing.
Because of all the stock he owns, Johnson still stands to make a fortune if he can put JCPenney back on track, says the University of Delaware's Charles Elson.
We'll have to see how it pans out. The bigger issue will be next year. Do things turn around?
And there's a precedent for survival. An Australian bank CEO had his pay cut by 99% in 2009. 4 years later, he's still the boss. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
So how much time do you spend at your local bank? Aside from a quick trip to the ATM once a week, I rarely step inside a bank anymore. You'd think banks would love that, right? Fewer in-person customers to deal with. But Bank of America is remaking its branches to be more customer-friendly. Think couches and iPads, among other things. Marketplace's Adrian Hill looks at how and why B of A wants to draw you back into the bank.
It feels like banks have been pushing us away for a while now. Bank in your living room. There's no need to bank at the bank. But now, Bank of America wants to get close, really close. Aditya Bastine is with the bank. He says customers want something different.
We're in a human era where their expectation of the brands that are important to them are that they're meeting their needs and they're doing it in a way that's eye-to-eye and human and connected. And humble.
Wait, humble? Bank? Barbara Kahn is a marketing professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. She says a focus on connection and being a good guy bank makes sense.
The real key to profitability in banking is for each customer they have to get more of their money, a higher share of wallet.
And to get a higher share of wallet, she says, we need to like our bank.
You have to feel comfortable with the bank. You have to want to have repeat business with the bank.
As part of the brand overhaul, the bank is launching ATMs with tellers available to video chat. It's also going to encourage customers to set up one-on-one conversations about personal finance goals. Yep, there will be talking. Greg Sterling is an analyst at Opus Research.
What I think these banks perhaps have found is that by introducing people to new services and trying to sell them through the internet or messages on their mobile devices has not been particularly effective.
Much better to have a real person making the pitch while they're making nice. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
So Bank of America is finding out technology can get in the way of business, but that doesn't seem to be the direction education is going these days. Online college courses, for one, and now here comes the RoboGrader. Pretty soon there will be free software on the internet that any school can use to grade student essays, not just multiple choice or true and false tests, but written essays. It's a new service from edX, a nonprofit that's offering free online courses. It'll be able to not only grade essays, but give instant feedback. We called up Joshua Kim, an education and technology expert at Dartmouth College, to get his take on all of this. Professor Kim, thanks for being here.
Hi, Sarah. Nice to be here.
So who do you think is going to use this essay grading software?
I hope that I get to use this in my own writing. The reason that I think that this is a great technology is that I think that we all need to write. And I know I do a ton of writing, and most of what I write is pretty bad. So the only way I get better is to write more and to write more. So if this technology encourages people to simply write more, I think it's a great thing. And I don't think we should be too worried about it.
Talk about this from the professor's point of view, though. Who do you think is going to be attracted to this? Overwhelmed college professors at big universities who have 400 essays to grade?
Well, the question is really not between a professor carefully grading an essay in a large class or not grading. The choice is really between doing something like this and not doing any writing and only doing multiple choice. So if a technology like this can introduce writing into large classes where the writing was not going on because the classes were too big, I think that's a great technology. Because again, what's really important is not the professor's feedback, although that's critical, of course, in smaller classes. But what's important is that students get the practice writing.
Isn't feedback critical in big classes, too? I mean, it's nice that you can be in a small class in college, but what about the people who are at big universities? They need feedback, too, human feedback.
Right. My guess is that software like this is not replacing professors giving comments and analysis of students' writing. My guess is that software like this will be introduced when there's really no way that the professors can give that feedback to writing. I mean, maybe this technology is sort of a gateway drug for getting people writing, and they'll end up in the small seminars that we all believe are what education should be about.
You know, this criticism in education, they're teaching to the test. Right. Is it possible, Professor Kim, that something similar can happen here if this software is widely adopted beyond what you're thinking about? Basically, kids learning to write for the robot, so to speak.
I think that any technology can be misused. And I think we're starting to see this with these massively open online courses, or people are thinking, and politicians are thinking, well, this is a substitute for really what goes on in higher education. So sure, you could think of all sorts of ways that a tool like this could be misused, but it's only a tool. It's a way to engage our students. It's a way to get them to think and to participate and to build. So it could be misused, but I'm not so worried about that.
Professor Kim, how do you grade your students? Do you use technology?
Well, you know, I have to say that right now I'm an administrator at my institution, but I do want to say that we have very small, intimate, online and blended courses, which are completely about the faculty working with our students, becoming colleagues with our students. This is not a tool that we would ever use for a final grade for our students, but if it's a way that our students can write and get some really instant feedback and rewrite before they submit their final paper or their final essay, I think that's terrific.
Joshua Kim is director of a learning and technology program at Dartmouth College. Professor Kim, thanks a lot.
It was great speaking with you, Sarah. Thank you.
Coming up.
Bad landlords are clever. They're going, hey, if I say I'm a sober living, I can hide behind federal protections.
Helping recovering addicts or helping themselves to big profits? First, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gave back 40 points, 0.25%, to rest at 14,565. The NASDAQ took off 21 points, 0.2%, to end at 3203. The S&P 500 dipped 6 points, 0.4%, to finish at 1553. For the week, the Dow ticked down 0.1%, the S&P 500 lost 1%, and the NASDAQ deleted nearly 2%. J.P. Morgan Securities says U.S. airlines could see lower revenues than expected, mainly because of the recent federal spending cuts. Delta Airlines dropped 2.5%, United Continental descended 0.1%. Bond prices rose, the yield on the 10-year T-note slid to 1.71%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. More than 9,000 space enthusiasts are expected in Colorado Springs for the annual National Space Symposium. Aluminum producer Alcoa starts the quarterly earnings season. And weather should be lovely in Augusta, Georgia, where golfers begin swinging in practice rounds for the 2013 Masters Tournament. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Sarah Gardner in for Kai Ristall. Here's a new twist on the American housing market. A growing number of homeowners are turning their properties into something called sober homes. A sober home is a place addicts can go to when they first come out of rehab. Residents there take drug tests, they go to 12-step meetings, and they have curfews. And today, strapped homeowners are tapping into this hot but sketchy new real estate market to help them pay their mortgages and even make a profit. Sarah Gross reports.
So this would actually be a really good sober living place.
Realtor Brian Wall is scouting properties in a suburb of L.A. He's looking for a particular kind of property.
Because you could have one person here, one person here, one person here, another six or eight people in the house.
Wall says sober homes have become a lucrative business for him. A single sale can net him up to $40,000. He says the perfect sober house has lots of bedrooms and is far away from nosy neighbors. That's because these homes can turn into overcrowded boarding houses that no one wants to live next to. Like this rundown house in the San Fernando Valley. More than 20 men live here, and they share just one bathroom with no door. The owner of the house refused to do an interview, but one of the residents reluctantly showed me around.
We turned that garage into a living facility because we were overcrowded, so we needed space.
Tenants say even the garage was being used as a bedroom. There were bunk beds to sleep a dozen men, but there was no heat, running water or electricity. When I went to see for myself, the house manager demanded I leave.
I don't want him in there, Phil.
You don't want him in there?
No, I want him in there.
Despite these appalling conditions, a bed here still costs as much as $500. When the house is full, the owner can net over $10,000 a month. Realtor Brian Wall says this kind of money is attracting people to the sober home business.
So if I'm not doing it to make money, then why am I doing it? And if I'm doing it for passion, that's great, but that doesn't help me open up 10 houses to provide more services.
But isn't the whole idea of sober homes supposed to be about helping addicts get back on their feet?
And if you want to call this a business, that's great. We don't. We call it service to these people.
Jeff Christensen is the director of a nonprofit called the Sober Living Network.
If we get back to the fundamentals of what this is about, it's a matter of life and death for the people that live there.
He says the problem is anyone can open up a sober home. And it's almost impossible to shut the bad ones down. That's because addicts are protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Bad landlords are clever. They're going, hey, if I say I'm a sober living, I can hide behind federal protections.
So how do you help recovering addicts when so many people are just trying to make a buck off them? Christensen says one solution is self-regulation. That's what his organization's all about, getting sober homeowners to agree to follow certain rules.
We do inspections. We go out and we take a look at their management practices.
One of the sober homeowners who took that training was Christopher Justin. He owns and manages six sober homes near San Diego.
There's such a demand and there's such a need. It's a great opportunity to be of service.
Justin finds recovering addicts at local churches, probation and parole offices, and through ads on Craigslist. Tenants pay him up to $500 for a single bed. But unlike some sober homeowners, Justin actually offers services like drug testing and counseling.
You have to be extra attentive to make sure that they don't have opportunities to fall back on old habits and old attitudes.
But soon, these sober homes, both good and bad, may disappear in Los Angeles. The city council is trying to pass an ordinance to shut them all down. Sober living advocates say it could leave thousands of recovering addicts with nowhere to go. In Los Angeles, I'm Sarah Gross for Marketplace.
Hundreds of millions of Chinese are taking a break from building the world's second biggest economy to tend to the graves of their ancestors. Tomb Sweeping Day was reinstated as a national holiday in China 5 years ago. Markets there are closed today, but as our China correspondent Rob Schmitz explains, the holiday means another kind of market is open for business, a celestial one.
For the Chinese, transferring money to the world of the dead requires no ID, no bank account, nor a PIN number. All you need is a lighter. Huang Zhifeng and her husband complete their first transfer by lighting up a stack of bills labeled heavenly currency in Chinese. They're knockoffs of the U.S. $100 bill, except Ben Franklin's profile has been replaced with the headshot of Confucius. They burn inside a rusty bucket at the foot of the gravestones next to that of Huang's mother and father.
Neighbors of my mother and father, please accept this money as a gift on behalf of your new neighbors.
Huang's mother was buried here 2 weeks ago. Huang bows to the neighboring gravestone, which belongs to a boy who died when he was 8. It's a marble tombstone in the shape of an open laptop. Money, food, even cardboard iPhones and iPads are burned by Chinese on this day in the belief that they'll be transferred to loved ones in their afterlife.
If we burn enough money, Mom and Dad will be able to open up a factory in heaven.
Before they do that, though, they'll have to settle into their new villa.
After my mom died, I bought a huge cardboard villa. It was fully furnished and even had a small electric refrigerator. I packed the clothes she'll need for winter and put them inside.
With the help of relatives, Huang lugged the 4-foot-tall villa to her mother's new tomb, took out her lighter, and promptly burned it down. Winterware, tiny electric refrigerator, and all. A few days later, Huang says she got a call from the daughter of a long-lost friend of her mother's.
It was really out of the blue. I hadn't heard from her in years. I told her my mom had died. She told me her mom, who used to be a dear friend of my mom's, had a dream the night before that my mom had moved to a new house in western Shanghai. That's where we are now.
And that's why Huang and her family keep adding silver and gold bullion cubes made of paper to the fire, alongside huge bundles of fake cash. It's a money transfer from one of the fastest-growing economies on the planet to the world of the deceased. Because you never know when heaven might be hit with a recession. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for MarketPulse.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And finally today, file this one under regrettable fashion trends. Apparently, the latest is men's pajama bottoms for day wear, outside, where people can see them. Retail analysts say flannel and silk PJ bottoms are like the new sweatpants for men. Sales are up 15% in the last year. Some of the pants go for as much as $110 a pair. You know, aside from the sloppiness factor, it just means so much more plaid on the streets. So I give this fashion trend a big Roger Ebert thumbs down. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gave back 40 points, 0.25%. The NASDAQ deleted 21 points, 0.67%. And the S&P 500 took off 6 points, 0.4%. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, dirty dishes, rotting food, petty theft. What is it about the office kitchen that brings out childish behavior in our coworkers?
When you open the fridge, it looks like kids are conducting science experiments. People don't have a sense of ownership over the workplace, that they don't care, that they don't invest enough in it.
Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Satara Nieves. The executive producer is Deborah Clark. JJ Yor is the vice president and general manager. I'm Sarah Gardner. Have a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.